there is no loss to me. It's a commodity. I can switch very easily with the same number, and there's no issue whatsoever. And for that person, I know that sounds like a fairly basic thing, but for that person, that was a revelation that they could save upwards of $50 to $100 a month on their family cell phone bill and put more money into whatever they wanted.
Hello, welcome back to Strictly Money, where finance and your prosperity meet. I'm Sejal Patel. Today, we are talking about an often neglected but crucial topic, and that is negotiation. Whether it's negotiating for a higher salary or negotiating for a better deal on that major purchase, mastering the art of negotiation can, believe it or not, drastically improve your financial health. I am so excited about today's guest because I have been listening to his podcast for well over a year. He is brilliant. He is insightful. He has taught me a thing or two about negotiation, and I think you are going to learn a lot. Mark Raffin is the CEO of Negotiations Ninja. He's an award-winning negotiations trainer, and he joins me now. Hey, Mark, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, Mark, I was saying just now that I have been listening to your podcast, Negotiations Ninja, for I'd say about a year. It's been really helpful to me. And so I know it's going to be helpful to our listeners and our viewers. So I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it as well. I think we're going to have a lot of fun together. And thank you for listening to my show. It's always great to hear from someone who listens.
I genuinely do. And I really do enjoy it. Mark, how did you get into this in the first place? How did you get into helping companies with negotiation skills?
I started my career out in sales, then I moved into procurement, and throughout that time realized that there is a massive gap that I feel like I needed to serve in the negotiation training space. Look, there are a lot of negotiation trainers out there, but most of them suck. So I decided that this is what I wanted to do and to rage against terrible negotiation training. And so 6.5 years ago, I started Negotiations Ninja, and now we develop and deliver some of the most engaging negotiation training in the world. But it actually all started because of the family that I grew up in, because I grew up in a very, this always sounds terrible whenever I say it, but I grew up in a very conflict-oriented household. And that's not to say that it was bad in any kind of way, but if my family ever has a problem with you, you're going to hear about it right away, right? They don't hold back what they're going to say. No one's ever soft around how they address conflict. Everyone just says what they need to say any and all times that they need to say it. And so actually what was more difficult for me coming out of that environment, going into the working world, was learning how to tone it back instead of learning how to deal with conflict. And so that led to the careers that I had in both corporate sales and corporate procurement, which actually worked out well for me because I wasn't afraid to have difficult conversations. I wasn't afraid to have conflict-oriented situations. And that helped me to negotiate much better deals and helped me to develop Negotiations Ninja.
And yet, so many people are, Mark, you know, they can't confront those difficult conversations. You know, Mark, I wanted you on because I feel that so much money is left on the table, that really some people are putting their financial health at risk because they don't negotiate. And I want to get your thoughts on it. And based on your experience, you know, how essential it is to someone's financial health.
Yeah, unfortunately, what you're observing is exactly what we observe. And it's true. A lot of people just choose not to negotiate. The vast majority of the time, it's because of fear of rejection, fear of ridicule, fear of looking like a fool, fear of looking like you're greedy. Or it could just be that there is just a lack of understanding that they can actually negotiate for things that they take for granted every day. And so we see exactly the same thing as you. People just choose not to negotiate. And what ends up happening is they lose a ton of value over the course of their lives in terms of savings, making more money, getting better deals, getting better services, all of those things that they should be doing, they're just not able to capture. And once people actually start negotiating, they realize, holy cow, I have been missing out on a ton of value. And that's why we would do what we do.
Do you think, Mark, that it is a cultural thing? And I ask this because, you know, I grew up in an Indian household. My mother is, I would say, one of the best negotiators when it comes to deals, but they were used to that. And then when I lived in Asia, it was very common practice to negotiate. I don't feel like that's necessarily the case in North America. And I know I'm wrong because people do negotiate here, but I feel like there's more of a stigma.
For sure there is. And I would say that many other cultures feel a lot more comfortable with it because they grow up in and around it, right? We see a lot of folks from the sort of South Asian community, a lot of folks from China and Taiwan and Vietnam and Cambodia and Africa and South America, very comfortable with negotiating because they've grown up in and around markets. They've seen their parents do it. It happens as a part of the daily culture. Whereas in a lot of Western cultures, North America, the UK, sometimes South Africa, Australia, it's almost seen as a bit of a taboo because you are sort of imposing on yourself the societal norm of what is or is not acceptable. Unfortunately, because of that, people miss out. They miss out on getting way better deals. Like I was having a conversation the other day with a friend of mine, for example, telling that person that, you know, I take my own medicine. I try to implement as much negotiation as I can in my daily life. And I was renegotiating my cell phone bill. And they said, oh, I didn't realize you could do that. I thought, you know, you get that first time offer. And that was kind of it. As long as, you know, you stay a customer, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, I want the first time offer all the time. Right. I want that to be continuous. And they said, but what if you have to accept a worse deal and choose a different cell phone provider? I said, well, then I'll choose a different cell phone provider. Like there is no loss to me. It's a commodity. I can switch very easily with the same number. And there's no issue whatsoever. And for that person, I know that sounds like a fairly basic thing, but for that person, that was a revelation that they could save upwards of $50 to $100 a month on their family cell phone bill and put more money into whatever they wanted.
And you know, Mark, you make a really good point because what's the worst that they're going to say? No.
Right. They say no. Okay, great. I'll speak to someone in your customer retention team now. Thank you. And then you speak to someone in customer retention. Maybe, chances are they won't, but maybe they even say no. And you go, okay, great. I'll most likely be switching. Let me go and research what Rogers or Bell or TELUS or whomever the opposing team is for you is offering and see if I can get a better deal.
I want to go back though. You made a really interesting point about, you know, negotiation and the stigma when we talk about culture. Do you see a difference? Because I do, but I'd like to get your thoughts on this. Do you see a difference between the way men and women negotiate? Because a lot of my financial education and my programs are very much geared towards women. And so I want to get your thoughts on that one.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. There is a stigma that exists with that. Unfortunately, women have to fight it from two different fronts, right? So they're fighting it from sort of a social stigma of, oh, if I negotiate, I'll be perceived as bossy or demanding or something like that. And then they're also fighting it from the normal own societal thing that everyone deals with of like, oh, I'm going to be perceived as greedy, or I'm going to lose out on an opportunity, or I'm going to look like a fool. And so they're fighting it from both fronts. The unfortunate reality is that in order to get more value, you have to ask for more. There's been a bunch of work done around this by Sarah Lashifer and Linda Babcock. Their great book is called Women Don't Ask, which is phenomenal.
Yes.
And both of those authors do an excellent job of identifying why this happens and then how to resolve it. But there's a bunch of women on LinkedIn and social media in general that talk about this topic extensively and offer really great tips. Like Vise Bratby, for example, I think she's based out of Switzerland. You could look her up on LinkedIn. She's phenomenal. Beth Fisher Yoshida is phenomenal. Alexandra Carter is phenomenal. Sarah Lashifer is phenomenal. Like they're amazing women out there that teach exactly how to fix this problem. But to answer your question, there's a serious problem around this. I see a lot of women choosing not to negotiate because of how they feel about a certain situation.
Yeah. And I want to talk about negotiating salaries because that's really the big one, right? there's been a lot of research done on this. And there's one that I was looking at that said that 60% of people don't actually negotiate their salary, and that they could be leaving up to, I said, about $500,000 to $1 million on the table over the course of their career. What do you think is the biggest misconceptions that people have when it comes to negotiating their salary?
Yeah, first of all, that statistic is true. I've read that same statistic. It's very alarming because if you choose not to negotiate over several jobs over the course of your career, you're missing out on tons of money. I think what a lot of people misconceive or maybe are misunderstanding about negotiating salaries and negotiating job offers is they think that if they negotiate, there's less likelihood of them getting the job, or there's more of a chance that the person who's offering their job is going to say no, that they're going to miss out on the opportunity. The reality is that whomever is offering you the job is most likely expecting you to negotiate. And when you don't negotiate, especially for corporate positions like the ones that we train people for, you're actually looked less highly upon than if you did negotiate. For example, if a salesperson chooses not to negotiate, or a procurement person chooses not to negotiate for a role that they are taking on, I would think twice about hiring that person now, because if you're not going to negotiate for yourself, how could I trust you to negotiate for me?
It makes a lot of sense.
It makes a ton of sense. And a lot of people, unfortunately, put themselves into the position of thinking, well, if I negotiate, I'm going to miss out on that opportunity. Look, the likelihood of that happening is so low that it's not even worth talking about. You owe it to yourself to negotiate for those things. Now, how you do that is very important. But before you get the job is when you have the most leverage in that negotiation relationship. Once you've gotten the job, you have significantly less leverage to negotiate a better deal. So it's much better to try and negotiate before you get the job than after you've gotten the job.
And that, you make a really good point, because I think there are some people who think, well, you know what, I'll just prove myself. And when they see, you know, how much I'm contributing to the company and how hard of a worker I am, that I'll get that raise. But that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, do that and negotiate and then try and get more, right? Like, negotiate before you sign the offer. And then also put in your best effort, prove yourself, show how well you're doing, and then ask again, right? There's no harm in asking. The worst that could happen is someone says no.
So Mark, let me ask you, are there sort of no-nos or faux pas when it comes to negotiating?
Certainly. I think how you ask is really important, right? Like, I never want people to think that they should demand anything or require something or quote unquote have to have something. Because as soon as you use words like that, you're starting to position yourself in absolutes. And as soon as something becomes an absolute, then you're putting yourself and the counterparty in a corner where they have to make a decision. Either they give you this thing or the deal is over. Instead, what I would prefer is that people position it as more flexible. Hey, thanks so much for the opportunity. I really, really appreciate it. I'm definitely going to take it. And also, before I decide to take it on, here's some things that I would like to discuss before we decide to move forward. And then you list those things that you'd like to discuss. Oh, I want higher salary. I want more time off. I want funds dedicated towards education. I need certain amount of flex days. I need certain amount of sick days, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whatever it is that you're looking for, so that you have more to ask for, more to discuss. But how you ask for it is simple. As long as you start thinking about, okay, I'm going to be polite, I'm going to be kind, and I'm going to be courteous. As long as you're polite, kind, and courteous, the vast majority of things that you could and should ask for are going to be taken well by the person that you're asking of those things. If you demand something like, well, I have to have this, now you're putting that person in a very difficult position, and also yourself, because if they say no, then there's nowhere to go from there.
Right. And you know, I'm really glad you mentioned that list, because I have found that most people will only negotiate their salary, but there's room to negotiate other things. And would you say that's a good strategy? You know, I want say, a 10% increase on the offer that you've given me. Would you consider 5 extra holiday day or vacation days, et cetera, because my experience is they may not give you everything, but you're giving them more room to negotiate.
Yes. And don't just think of it in terms of the salary that you're getting. Think of the total package that you're negotiating, right? Benefits, time off, flex time, salary, education funding, all of those kinds of things should be things that you talk about with whomever is offering you the job. If you just negotiate salary and they say no to the salary, you've missed out on all of this available real estate that you can take advantage of that could have been discussed, but you chose not to. So by asking for more, you're improving the probability of success that you're actually going to get more. And I think a lot of people struggle with that. And the way that I like to flip it back to people is to say, okay, I understand why you struggle with that in terms of asking for more, but let me ask you this. What is the probability of you getting more if you don't ask for it?
Zero.
So in order to dramatically improve the probability of success, you have to ask for more. Otherwise, don't expect someone to just gift it to you, right? Like, these are large corporations or corporations in general. They have no soul, right? Like, the person that you're negotiating with might care, but they also have objectives and targets. That's their job. In order for you to get more, you have to ask.
I love these tips and more to come. But Mark, we're going to take a quick commercial break. We're going to hear from our sponsors, BMO ETFs, whom without I would not be able to do this show. So we'll take a break and we'll be right back. Are you looking to enhance the level of cash flow from your investments? BMO ETFs has you covered with their covered call ETFs. These ETFs generate cash flow from two sources, the dividend yield from the underlying securities and the premium generated from selling the call options. BMO covered call ETFs strike a balance between generating cash flow and participating in the growth of rising markets with your experienced portfolio management team and effective strategy with over 10 years of history. BMO ETFs is the largest covered call ETF provider in Canada, covering 13 covered call ETFs across a range of strategies across regions, countries, and sectors. Visit BMOETFs.com to learn more. Please read the ETF facts or prospectus of the BMO ETFs before investing. Welcome back. I'm here with negotiations expert, Mark Raffin. Mark, we've been talking about negotiating salaries. Another area I feel that people should be negotiating is big purchases, things like cars, even homes, when you're looking for homes. And I want to get your thoughts on the approach that people should take.
Some of this information is going to rub a few people the wrong way. So at the risk of offending a few people and ruffling a few feathers, this is going to land differently for a few folks. If you're not negotiating for those things, you're potentially losing hundreds of thousands of dollars, potentially millions of dollars over the course of your lifetime. Now, that sounds like a shocking number, but if you extrapolate one major purchase or one major sale over the course of your life, obviously that's true. Let's first start with cars. If you're negotiating a car, every piece of available information, at least in Canada, is available to you around what the cost makeup of that car is, including the landed cost at the dealership. It's all available online. Everything is available to you. So for you not to do your research and find out what that costs, and then negotiate based on that cost with, obviously, we want whomever we're negotiating with to make a little bit of money, would be foolish. The other thing is you've probably done a ton of research to figure out what car exactly you want before you've even walked onto the dealership. So for you to not look at the cost makeup of that car and what the landed cost is at the dealership would be very disadvantageous for you. Now, the reality is that cars are a commodity. They're not custom, unless you're ordering some beautiful custom-made Lamborghini straight from Italy that's being flown in for you on a private jet. I'm going to assume that that's not happening. Cars are a commodity. So if you don't get the deal that you want at one dealership, go to another dealership and try again. And make sure that you are shopping around to ensure that you get close to the deal that you're looking for. But obviously try and maintain a margin of error in some sort of capacity. So if I know what the price is and what I want included with that vehicle and what floor mats and tires and et cetera, and I know what that roundabout cost is going to be, plus minus 1 or 2% on either side is probably where you want to be, depending on where you're negotiating, depending on how many dealerships are available to you, depending what the market is in your current location. If you don't get that kind of a deal, go elsewhere. It's a commodity purchase. Realize that that's just the way it is. Now, that changes based on the market that you're in. Right? 6 months ago, 7 months ago, negotiating for a car is almost impossible, right? Like, because they have people lined up to get cars right after COVID. It depends. It depends on the market that you're playing within. How you negotiated a car for today is going to be different than how you negotiated that same car 2 years ago or 1 year from now. So take that into account whenever you're negotiating and realize that the market that you're playing with in may have changed.
Okay, let's talk about homes.
Homes are less of a commodity purchase because of the emotional attachment to them. The unfortunate truth is that people fall in love with these places because they live in these places. And I would be remiss if I said to you something as cliche as leave your emotions at the door. Because that's just not going to happen. Instead, what I want you to do is try to manage your emotions as best you can and realize that when you're negotiating for a home, you've got a ton of different moving pieces. First, you're dealing with your own emotions. Second, you're dealing with someone who's representing you in the negotiation. Third, you're dealing with the person that is being represented in the negotiation and their agent as well. So there are essentially four parties in this negotiation. Some people think that there's two, but there is actually four, right? There's me, my agent, the counterparty, and their agent. Now, I choose to have an agent represent me in a negotiation because I get emotional in negotiations. And the instructions that I give to that agent are to ensure that my emotions aren't too tied into it. Herein lies a bit of a rub with real estate negotiations if you choose to use an agent, which I recommend, by the way. If you choose to use an agent, recognize that that agent, this is going to rub a few people the wrong way, is not really incentivized to get you a phenomenal deal.
Of course not, because they make a commission on the selling price.
Right. And that commission really doesn't change plus minus $5,000 or $10,000, right? The relative change based on that commission is irrelevant. So they're probably not incentivized to be the best negotiator for you. That being said, they are working for the transaction and not necessarily the deal. The differentiation there is really important because their goal is to expedite the transaction so that they can get better commissions, so that they can do that. Now, I know I'll have a bunch of realtors say, well, that's not true, Mark. We're serving the customer and all that kind of stuff. And I recognize that there are a few great realtors out there who do truly do that. And I highly encourage you to use an agent whenever you can. But that also means that you need to have a really heart-to-heart discussion with that agent, with that realtor, to ensure that they know what your goals are. They know at what stages you're willing to concede in the negotiation. They know what you are willing to concede, and they know what you are willing to go up to, and all of those kinds of things. Because if you don't have that heart-to-heart with them, you don't have those instructions that you give them, you don't tell them what you're willing to concede and when you're willing to concede and how you're willing to concede on different items, you're giving them permission to act in your best interest for the transaction. So depending on how you want to approach that will largely depend upon the deal that you're getting. Now, in Canada, in most major cities, the reality is that if you are purchasing a home, you are competing. So in many of those negotiations, you've just got to try and determine what your cap is rather than what you want to discount to.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm so glad you talked about this because I just went through that, you know, a couple of months ago. And I probably spent a good 6 months, kept getting outbid, but I knew my max. And luckily, I did have a really good real estate agent. And I tell you, for me, and I give this advice to other people, when you think that it's just that dream home and you're never going to find something like this, something else does come along. And I always hung out to that hope. You know, when I saw something and I really liked it, I missed out, I was bummed. But I ended up in a great home. And of all the homes that I bid on, this was the one that I ended up in.
What you said, though, is very important. You recognized what your guardrails, like how much you wanted to spend in the negotiation, what you, the line in the sand, basically, where you decided, okay, if we go above this, I have to walk away from this negotiation. Most people don't do that work. Most people don't understand. Yeah.
No, it's FOMO, right? You feel like, well, look at the outbidding that happened even during the pandemic. It was insane. Yeah,
it's alarming. And I know that one of the things that you teach is obviously you're not going to try and purchase more than you can afford, because the payments for that and the cash flow required and the amount of debt that you have to take on and the stress that's involved in that sometimes for a lot of people is far too much. And so please, this is so important for anyone listening to, if you're thinking about a big purchase or anything like that, please, please, please work very closely to identify what your line in the sand is. Because what I don't want to have happen is that you get wrapped up in the emotion of the bidding process when you go into a negotiation because you, quote unquote, really love this house. And then you end up overextending yourself as a result of making the winning bid. You get the house, you're elated, everything's fantastic, but now your mortgage is an extra $60,000, right? We don't want that to happen. That's horrific. It could actually destroy you financially. So please make sure that you know exactly what your line in the sand is.
Yeah, great, great advice, Mark. I want to switch gears and I want to talk about price versus value. And if this is something that you talk about when teaching negotiation skills, because I personally don't know if people actually understand the difference.
Yeah. So price is the sticker that you put on the thing. Value is the stuff that you're getting out of the thing. For example, I buy a car that is priced at $20,000, but the value, because I drive a lot for my job, for example, I'm just using an example, the value could be significantly greater than the $20,000 that I pay for the car. That's not to say that you shouldn't negotiate the price, but it is to say that you should recognize the value that's associated with the thing that you're buying or the thing that you're selling. For example, our negotiation training, we train people in teams in large Fortune 100s, Fortune 500s, and the price that's attached to our training is very expensive. But the value generates tens of millions and hundreds of millions of dollars in savings and future revenue opportunity. So comparatively, when we have that conversation with whomever the leader is that's decided to get their team enrolled in our training, the conversation is fairly straightforward because we are going to generate a significant amount more value for you for what comparatively feels like a very low sum of money. Now, if I didn't have that value conversation and I just said, here's the price, I would immediately lose that opportunity because someone would just go, whoa, holy smokes, that's really expensive. Yes, without understanding value, it feels expensive. But once you understand the value that you're going to get out of it, it really is very little money.
I'm glad you said that because, and to another point, you know, you talk about value, but it's also the return on investment. And I see this all the time. You know, I have a program, an online course, and it's not price expensive, but some women will say, oh, that's too much. And I think, well, hold on. What's the return on investment? If I'm teaching you how to save, how to pay down debt strategically, how to build wealth, how to make sure you're protected, that's a skill and, you know, knowledge that's going to pay you a lifetime.
Yeah. I mean, the first question, whenever someone asks me the question of like, oh, that's too expensive, or says that, I'll say, relative to what? Like, what are you comparing us to make the statement that this is too expensive? And then they'll list off a bunch of other stuff. And that for me is like the key indicator that either they've done their research or they haven't done their research. And if they haven't done their research, what a phenomenal opportunity for me to be able to educate them about why we do what we do and how we price what we price. If they have done their research, it allows me the opportunity to compare and contrast between us and others, to be able to say, here's the value that you're getting. You have to make the ultimate decision about whether or not that works for you.
Can you share, Mark, a success story in some of the work that you've done that has helped someone vastly improve their financial situation?
Yeah, for sure. So typically we train procurement teams and sales teams on how to negotiate large commercial deals. So typically, it's a procurement team that has a spend, so a corporate spend, how much the company spends, of over $1 billion, or a sales team that generates over $100 million a year in revenue. Now, all of the skills and the techniques and the frameworks that we teach in those commercial B2B negotiations can be and should be applied to your personal negotiations as well. One such story is when we taught a procurement team how to negotiate better, gave them frameworks to be able to do that. And in that same training session, a half an hour later, they came back and said, you know, we had a plumbing issue in our condo, a pipe burst. And in that situation, it was very, very tempting to get emotional about the situation and just pay whatever we need to pay. But I asked the question, can we get a better deal? Something super simple. Can we get a better deal? Not even phrased well, not phrased correctly, but just being present in the moment enough just to get the question out. They saved 30% on that plumbing bill just by asking. That's the reality of good negotiations, because in that situation, your emotions are tied to something chaotic and crazy. If you could just give yourself the opportunity to just pause and ask, you will generate massive success.
Do you feel like it's muscle memory too? That, you know, you just got to do it and practice and you'll get better at it.
Yeah, the more you ask, the better you're going to get at it, because the skill that we're building in asking is not actually asking. The skill that we're building in asking is learning how to deal with the fear that we have associated with what we perceive to be rejection. So we're not actually training people how to ask better. That comes with advanced training. When we first start out, we're training people how to deal with the fear of rejection. And the more that you ask, the better that you're going to get at dealing with that fear, so that when you ask later on, the question becomes better, how you ask becomes better, and then that improves. And then eventually what you'll start to see is that your numbers start to go up because you've now dealt with the fear. Now you're starting to optimize how you ask. And when you start to optimize how you ask, the things that you get as a result of asking increase.
I love it. I love it. I really, Mark, I really appreciate you coming on today. Now, I know you have training programs for large corporations, which is fantastic. I do want to mention that you have a book on Amazon. It's called 9 Secrets to Win Deals and Influence Stakeholders. But you also, for individuals, you also have a number of free ebooks on your website. Can you just talk quickly about that?
Yeah, we got a number of different ebooks on the website on persuasion, presentations, how to negotiate, how to develop a plan for negotiation, all available on the website. So if folks just go to negotiations.ninja, they can go straight to the homepage, all available on the homepage.
And I'll make sure I have it in the show notes as well. Mark, before I let you go, you don't know this, but I always ask my guests 3 rapid fire questions. So
pressure's on.
Are you ready for this?
Yeah. I'm ready.
No trick question here. Okay. So first question, what is the best financial advice you've ever received?
Don't spend more than you have.
Basic one. Sometimes very hard to follow for some people.
Very hard to follow. So hard to follow.
Yeah. Yeah. Good one. Okay. Then what is the worst financial advice you've ever received?
It was without context. It was good advice without context. Use debt to leverage the ability to invest more. That without context and how to do that is very dangerous advice. And I got it without context.
Okay. Yeah, because there is such thing as productive debt. If you can use debt for assets that appreciate, and I also include investing in your own skills, that matters and it counts. Yeah. Okay, last one. If you could enact a law that people had to follow that would help them with their financial health, what would it be?
Required monthly or biweekly automatic investing into an investment of your choice, whatever it is. But it would, if it was a law that was required, I would require that today.
Yeah, good one. That's, I guess, why we have something like a CPP. And I'm with you. You know, I think if you leave it up to people, they'll have a reason not to invest. If you take that away and just force people to do it, they will thank you later.
Yeah, I think what a lot of people struggle with CPP is they don't see the number.
They don't see it until much later.
They take the money, okay, but now what? Where does it go? It goes into some magical black hole in the middle of nowhere. I don't know how they're doing. How are they communicating that? And so a lot of people are like, well, where is it? What does it do? Meanwhile, the CPP is doing phenomenally well and it's making a ton of money. And it's run by really, really well-educated people, but no one knows that, right? No one sees the returns or anything like that. And so everyone's like, I don't know where it goes. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. And they're not thinking about retirement when they're young. You know, it kind of creeps up as we know. Mark, thanks again so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it as well.
Well, that does it for this episode. If you liked today's show and what we talked about, please share it, leave a comment, leave a review, and don't forget to subscribe. We'll see you back here next week. Until then, stay well, stay wise, and stay wealthy.